Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Harold Holzer. He is one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln. He has authored or co-authored 30 books on Lincoln and the Civil War, has won a number of awards for his work, including a Lincoln Prize for his book Lincoln at Cooper Union. He is the Senior Vice President for External Affairs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and is also co-chairman of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. This morning, we will be talking about some of what you will find in his most recent book. And the title of the book is Lincoln, President-Elect, Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter 1860-1861. That's the subtitle. And the book looks at a very brief but important period in Lincoln's life, and that is the months between his election and his inauguration. And at the time that Lincoln was elected president, this was a much longer period than it is now. We'll talk some more about that as we talk with Harold Holzer. The book is out now. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and you can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore. Also, I would like to mention that our guest is, over the weeks to come, traveling all around the country talking about Lincoln. And this week, at the end of this week, he will be in Chicago. On Friday at 6 in the evening, he'll be giving a talk at the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop. And then the next day, he'll be at the First Division Museum in Chicago between 9 and 5. So certainly, we know that the bookshop appearance is open to the public, and anybody who is in the Chicago area and would like to hear him and see him, you can stop by there. And of course, if you just like to read the book or some of his other books, you can go down to the bookstore and the library and check him out. And this morning on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Holzer, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. A lot of really interesting things here in this book, and I guess I found myself really absorbed maybe almost a little bit more in the small personal details of daily life. Obviously, here at this point, there were big issues that Mr. Lincoln was wrestling with. He was thinking about the country. He was thinking about slavery. He was thinking about who was going to be in his cabinet, all those things. And we can talk about those things. But I don't know. Somehow it was just the little things and imagining what it must have been like for him at this point where, after he'd been elected, was just mobbed by people, a lot of people just wanting to see him and meet him and wish him well, but even more so people who, because he was going to be the president, were looking for a job. They wanted something. And he was constantly surrounded by these people. After he was elected, even on Christmas Day, he met with people like this. So it must have been, for him, a very, very, in many ways, a very challenging time.
You know, it was challenging, but in a way, it was probably energizing for him, because true to the culture of his time, and I know that some of us wish we were living in that culture again for the following reason, he did no campaigning between May of 1860 when he was nominated and November of 1860 when he was elected. And this is a guy who was used to speaking, you know, before big crowds and small crowds and anywhere where anyone would listen. He was very tight-lipped and wrote very few letters and unusually inactive, suspended his law practice, and he needed that human contact. So I think, in a way, he was pleased that he was suddenly had opened shop for business in the state capitol in Springfield, where he had a temporary office, and people would indeed line up outside from an early hour and just wait and almost unimaginable to us today. They had completely open access to the next president.
And just your mention of his not campaigning, this between the point of being nominated and being elected, that was simply the way that it was done. Nobody did that. And in fact, he didn't attend the nominating convention. He wasn't there. And I also thought it was remarkable. One of the things here is that the man who would become his vice president And I'm a little confused on this because I think in the book it says two different things. Is it the case that, in fact, until after the election, they hadn't even met?
Well, there's the confusion is deeply reflects my own confusion. Hannibal Hamlin was the guy.
Yeah.
And he was not anointed by Lincoln the way Governor Palin and Senator Biden were anointed by their respective presidential candidates this time. He was chosen by the convention, and they decided regional balance was the thing, and they had a Northwesterner in Lincoln, so they needed an Easterner, Northeasterner in the man from Maine. Lincoln's had a vague recollection that they had met when they both served in the same Congress. Lincoln was a member of the House of Representatives in 1847 and 1848, and Hamlin was a United States Senator. They surely did things together. They passed each other in the hall. They were both anti-slavery guys. I'm sure they said hello. Hamlin had no recollection. It's pretty hard to forget a guy who looked like Lincoln, but Hamlin seems to have forgotten. Huh. So when they met in Chicago, Lincoln played the game and very graciously said that he didn't know that they'd met before. So it was that's the way it went. But it is amazing. They didn't even talk to each other, but really once or twice during the campaign, when Lincoln got annoyed with something he was saying. Other than that, even that is different. No contact at all.
Mm. Something else that is a notable difference between that time and this is that today the period between the election and the inauguration is, I think, about 10 weeks, 2.5 months. At this point, because the inauguration was still in March, it was 4 months.
Four full months.
That's a very long time to be in this period where you have the president-elect who essentially, because he's not sworn in yet, has no power. But you also have the sitting president. Talk about lame ducks, and particularly with President Buchanan was, he may not have been a stellar performer and certainly wasn't at this time. That's a long time for really almost nobody to be in charge.
It's a long time for a lame duck without a cast on his leg or something, or whatever you do for a literal translation. And Buchanan was facing a crisis of huge proportions, not unlike what President Bush is dealing with now, but, at least exercising some initiative. Buchanan was just in a dither because he didn't believe that states had the right to secede from the Union, but he also didn't believe that the federal government had the right to interfere with states who seceded from the Union. So he was paralyzed. So one man is powerless and one man is paralyzed, and the country is dissolving before the eyes of both North and South. We think we have a crisis now. It's just nothing like what was faced by Lincoln and by Americans in 1860.
Yeah, and to remind people that during this time when Lincoln was waiting, he had been elected, was waiting to be inaugurated in December. The South Carolina became the first state to secede. By January, there were another five. By early February, the Confederacy was formally created, and still Lincoln had yet to be inaugurated.
There are actually two journeys to Washington that happened almost simultaneously, and quite by accident, obviously. The secessionists and the Lincoln men did not share schedules in advance, but as it happened, Lincoln and left Springfield for Washington around exactly the same time that Jefferson Davis left Alabama to assume the presidency of the Confederacy. He left his hometown to go to Montgomery, Alabama, and so they were just twin rival inaugural journeys. It was an interesting portent of what would happen in the war if you buy into the theory that the North was destined to prevail because of its superior technology and manpower. Lincoln was able to take a direct route to Washington, well, as direct as he wanted it to be. He certainly wanted to stop in friendly cities and speak and go to parties and what presidents-elect get to do. Davis actually had to travel all the way north and then all the way south when a direct route would have been very brief, and that's because the South did not have the railroad infrastructure that the North had. They should have realized that they had a problem right then. Would have saved a lot of trouble.
One of among the many really interesting things about the book is this you know, this business of how you spend this period and what people generally did, and that it was rather than essentially, you know, proceeding in a fairly direct way from being elected to being inaugurated, that it was the practice that people would, in a sense, take their time traveling, and that would do that, would stop various places along the way, would make speeches, would make appearances. You know, at that point, I suppose it would be an opportunity for a person to talk about what was really important and address the issues of the day. You know, one of the things that I wonder is that, given the fact that between his being selected as the nominee and the election, there was no campaigning, how did people decide who they were going to vote for and what the person stood for, and, you know, who somebody was campaigning if it was not the candidate?
Oh, yeah, there were plenty of surrogates. And just as Hillary Clinton is out there campaigning for Barack Obama today, William H. Seward, who had been bested by Lincoln for the nomination, though he, like New York's current senator, was the favorite. He was the senator from New York then. He went out and campaigned for Lincoln. And there was, of course, lots of organizational activity, parades, picnics, etc. In those days, people took the party platforms very seriously. The platforms were published, they were read, they were digested, they were discussed. And Lincoln firmly believed that he had, by accepting the nomination, he had sworn fealty to the platform, and that was all people needed to know. He also referred people very often to his, quote, published speeches, and by those he meant the Lincoln-Douglas debates, whose publication he had arranged personally in a book form, not just newspapers, and also his more recent Cooper Union address in New York City, which had been an enormous success and which he repeated in other cities in the Northeast, but which also then appeared in a number of pamphlet editions in several languages, and was available as well for purchase from, you know, publishers in New York, Chicago, Springfield, Washington. These, he thought, set out his moderate policy, which is that he would not interfere with slavery in the states where it existed, but he absolutely refused to countenance the extension of slavery into other territories in the West. And, of course, party affiliation was much stronger then. Today we have such a huge middle in our voting blocks of independents who are not affiliated. But in the 19th century, almost everybody was either a Democrat or a Republican, even though the Democrats broke up into some, you know, into splinters. People just went out and voted their party, believed in the credo and the platform of the party, and exercised their franchise according to ideas.
Our guest in this part of Focus, let me just very quickly introduce again, is Harold Holzer. He is the co-chairman of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, and he has authored or co-authored 30 books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, one that we have talked about on this program, and he just mentioned, the book is Lincoln at Cooper Union, which is about the Cooper Union speech, which
right.
You just mentioned, and also his brand new book is Lincoln, President-Elect, which takes a look at what was going on in that period between his election and his inauguration, a four-month period.
By the way, could I interrupt to make one point?
Yes, sir, please.
You know, it was an agonizing wait, and it was filled with these diversions and pressure and people coming and asking for favors. But Lincoln, in I guess what we would today call true Gore versus Bush fashion, he was really worried about whether his popular victory, that is, the victory in the Electoral College on November 6th, would be ratified by the Electoral College. He had real concerns that they would be if the states were seceding, he thought that they would also mount a campaign not to participate in the Electoral College process. So there was a December 15th. Deadline at which all of the state electors had to meet in their various state capitals and ratify their state's choices. Lincoln was concerned about that. This proceeded without a hitch. And then, in February, the states were scheduled to go to, the votes were scheduled to be opened in Washington. Well, what would happen if the Southern senators didn't come to the to the session, would there be a quorum? If there wasn't a quorum, would the reading be legal? Could the reading proceed? What if someone tried to disrupt? So the irony was, although seven states had seceded by this time, all of their votes were duly recorded and announced by the sitting vice president who had lost the presidential election, just as Al Gore was required by law to do when he announced the disputed election of 2000. Mm. So he had a lot of anxious moments, in addition to just the most anxious moments of all, which was worrying about whether he would have a country to lead.
So he not only was he concerned, there was concern, first of all, about whether he would win the election in the first place.
Right.
And then what would happen as the process worked itself along? Would he ever make it to inaugurate? And of course, there also were concerns for his personal safety.
Absolutely. So you worry about the worry was whether he would make it in different ways, absolutely. Hideous threats about what would happen to him if he decided to go to Washington. And then, of course, he travels completely in the open, makes speeches from hotel balconies, railroad stations, porches, and exposes himself, in a good way, to hundreds of thousands of people, probably more people than had ever seen a president of the United States or a soon-to-be president in history up to that point.
This, I'm struck by the fact that after he's elected, there is no provision, as far as the government is concerned, with providing him with any staff. So he had to do that himself. There was even no provision for providing him with any bodyguards. He had to do that for himself.
He had to do it all for himself, and he had to finance his journey to Washington to some degree. For himself, there aren't too many records of how these elaborate hotel suites were paid for in Indianapolis and Columbus and Albany and New York City. But I do know that his long stay at what we call the Willard now, it was called Willard's then in Washington, was his own personal obligation. Because months pass and he gets a dunning letter from Willard's saying, you know, what about this bill? And Lincoln is really angry, not at Willard's but at his staff for not taking care of it, and it orders that a draft be prepared and sent over there. So I have a suspicion that he paid for a lot of these things himself. Mm-hmm. There was no money left in the Republican Party coffers, and there was, again, no provision to transport the president.
One thing, overall point, I want to make sure that we make, and I think it has to do with your interest in exploring this time and writing this book, is that many, many historians have been critical of Lincoln, and they have said things like, well, of course, that he was a great president, but they have found fault with the way that he dealt with this very difficult period and with the national crisis that was going on. You seem to be wanting to say, well, let's look at this closely and find that, in fact, his record, what he did during this period, is much more positive, or at least it he shouldn't perhaps get the criticism that he has gotten about this time.
Yeah, I think just as for generations it was believed that Lincoln was, you know, a country lawyer who made good jury speeches, as Henry Fonda did in the movie, but was unremarkable. I think that reputation has been transformed by publication, discovery, and research and publication of the Lincoln Legal Papers, which shows he had a very sophisticated and broad practice, including an appeals practice, and was enormously successful in the end. I think this period cries out for that kind of re-exploration. The tradition has been that Lincoln dithered, that he didn't take the crisis seriously, and that he might have stepped in more forcibly, even if it meant breaking precedent and prevented the carnage that was the war. Did he underestimate what that war would be? Yes, that he did, and so did everybody else in the United States. And he would say in his, not his first inaugural, but his second, that no one anticipated the magnitude nor the duration of the war that ensued. But Lincoln was fully aware of the choices, the alternatives, and the facts, even in a position of legal powerlessness. His choice was to yield on the issue that had inspired his reentry into politics 7 years earlier and his rise from relative obscurity to the brink of the White House. And that issue was that if you stop the extension of slavery, if you don't give people the right to vote to enslave other people in new territories, even if you don't abolish slavery in the South, which of course you're not empowered to do, no president is empowered to do at that point, you sort of inhibit its growth. It strangles on itself. It goes on the course, as he put it, of ultimate extinction. You stop creating new slave states with slave senators who would perpetuate a majority that would make the system last forever. And on that, he had a choice. Either you go back on that inspiriting pledge, that core belief, or you maintain it. And his choice was to maintain it. If he went back on the platform, went back on his political soul, slavery might exist for another 100 years in the United States. He had no way of knowing how or when it would end. And he wasn't willing to do that. And for that, I think he deserves credit, not sanction.
At the same time, though, it seemed that he was at pains to try to send a message to the South and the Southerners and the Southern members of Congress that he was not about to end slavery there, that he bore the South no ill will, that he wasn't interested in making war on the South. I mean, it sounds in a way that he's almost wanted to have it all ways.
Oh, well, sure. Don't we all, and don't all leaders? But, well, he wanted reassurance without weakness. He wanted conciliation without concession. He was not diverting from Republican doctrine by saying that he wouldn't interfere with slavery in the South, because he had absolutely no legal power to do so, and it was extremely unlikely that he would ever be able to encourage a constitutional amendment. How in the world would 3/4 of the states agree to end slavery without compensation for what was the largest economic interest in the United States? Sort of like the stock market seems to be today. So he wasn't doing anything radical by saying, I'm not interfering. He was just stating the obvious in that case. But I think he also knew politically that it wasn't going to be enough, that the slaveholding interest wanted expansion of slavery, wanted expansion of its majority in Congress. That was the whole idea. Wanted, you know, expansion of its economic advantage by using free human labor. So, yeah, I think he was being conciliatory, but again, like the political campaign, he said nothing new publicly. He believed that making that kind of a speech that you've paraphrased, and that certainly was his private message, making many speeches like that would be a sign of weakness, and he wasn't willing to show weakness either. He wanted to show resolve, and that he would have resolve in a crisis.
We are at our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll get to in just a moment, but I would like to introduce again our guest, Harold Holzer, a man who is well known for writing about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. He's the author or co-author of a number of books, including his most recent that is titled Lincoln President-Elect. And it is about that period between Lincoln's election and inauguration. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It is just out now. He's spending some time and will be in the weeks ahead traveling around the country talking about Lincoln and the book. And in fact, this week, at the end of this week, he'll be in Chicago Friday at 6 in the evening at the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop, and then at the First Division Museum the next day between 9 and 5. And certainly we know that the bookshop appearance is free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested up in the Chicago area can stop by and see him. And, of course, you can go to the bookstore, you can go to the library and look at some of his other books as well, including the brand new one. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 is the number to call if you'd like to call in with a question. And we'll go right to someone here in calling from Rankin. They're on a cell phone, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I don't know how good my connection is, so just a couple of quick observations. Your guests can feel free to comment on them. Touched on it a little bit. Was just wondering, the inauguration of Lincoln, I believe, took place in Chicago at the Wigwam Club, which I think was located on Lake Street. And I was wondering if the author wanted to comment why Chicago was selected. In other words, was it already becoming a political powerhouse, or was it happenstance? Was there a method to the madness? And then I was wondering, as far as the impact of Mary Lincoln, Lincoln's wife, was Lincoln already aware of Mary's problems, and did he think her limitations was going to play an impact on his presidency? In other words, you know, was he looking at this as like, I have to do something with this lady, or did that really not come into play? And then finally, you mentioned the Civil War, and I think it wasn't until the end that actually became a war of attrition, where it was just, you know, who could pile the bodies up the fastest. And I was wondering if you thought Lincoln finally became aware of that with the help of Grant and Sherman, or how did that come to be? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right.
Those are three big topics. Okay. The caller is absolutely right. I think he said inauguration, but meant
I think
nomination.
He meant the nominating, yeah. The convention, yeah.
Right. The convention was held at this big temporary structure called the Wigwam on Lake Street, which Lincoln got to see when he came to Chicago. He actually, his only two town trips after his election, before leaving for Washington, were to one to visit his mother, his stepmother on the prairie, and the other to go to Chicago, which was sort of a fun time for him. Have receptions and meet people. But the caller is absolutely right that the choice of the Wigwam and Chicago was the biggest stroke of luck for Lincoln. And I'm not certain that he would have been nominated had the convention not been held there. The floor demonstrations were such, the galleries were so pro-Lincoln, that when he came close in the first ballot, even though he wasn't ahead, the balconies just erupted with cheers and enthusiasm, and I think it helped move some delegates off their first choices and to Lincoln on the second ballot. And how did it happen? It was a definite scheme by Lincoln supporters in Illinois to go to the national committee and say, it's our turn, we have a perfect place. It's like the Chicago campaign for the Olympics. You should have Norman Judd and Lincoln's other pals go out and try to get the Olympics. They were good, and it made a huge difference. Subject of Mary is interesting. I'm sort of sympathetic to Mary in many ways, because I think a lot of male historians are unreasonably tough on her and hold her to a standard that's unreasonable, because if she was ill, whether it's, you know, emotionally or psychologically, she's no more to blame for that than if she was Elizabeth Edwards and had a physical ailment. You can't blame people for being sick. I think it requires a little bit of sympathy. Mary was, you know, had emotional disturbances that later manifested themselves very seriously, and I think she deserves our sympathy. She did not have an easy time, and neither did Lincoln, because he had a lot on his mind and on his plate and couldn't give her the attention that she really desperately needed. But the caller asked a very interesting and specific question, and that is whether Lincoln was aware of her problems at this stage. I went into the project not really looking at that as a major focus, but I was surprised to find evidence that he was sort of aware. She was interfering in cabinet selection, writing letters to his campaign manager behind her husband's back, trying to get him not to appoint one of the people Lincoln wanted to appoint or was thinking of appointing. She was running up huge bills on a New York shopping spree. She was apparently, and I'm sure his son told him the story because he told others, she raised hell in Buffalo when she didn't get a free ticket on the train on her way back to Springfield. She had a tantrum one day when she couldn't get someone appointed who she wanted to get appointed to the federal bureaucracy, and someone actually visited Lincoln at home and was ushered into the parlor to find Lincoln seated very sadly on a sofa and Mary on the floor, pounding her fists on the floor. So I guess he was aware of the problem. It seemed pretty manifest. And yet he was remarkably understanding and loving. When she was in New York and had not announced her return with finality, Lincoln was at the railroad station in the snow every night for two or three nights waiting for the train, hoping that she'd be on it. A good fellow in many ways, and a good husband in as little time as he had to be a good husband. He was a loving husband, I think. The war is such a big topic, that final question. I'll just leave it at you ask if Lincoln was aware of what it would take to win the war. I will recommend two other books that are go into that are rather new, and one is Tried by War by James McPherson, a new book on Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief, and the other is Lincoln and His Admirals by Craig Symonds, S-Y-M-O-N-D-S. Two really good books about Lincoln as a commander and understanding what winning the war would require in terms of total war and also of joint operations.
All right. Well, I want to thank the caller. Go on. We have someone else. This is a caller here where we are in Champaign County, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm the one that brings up the dissident book, I guess, heretical book by called Forced into Glory, and I'm drawing a blank on the name.
Lerone Bennett.
Yes, of course.
From Chicago.
Right. And I saw him at the Lincoln Scholars talk a while back on Lincoln's birthday at the Old State House, and it was quite amazing. And there's a lot to summarize in his book, and I won't try, but one of the most salient things that stuck out for me was Bennett's documentation that Lincoln, over the objections of the and without authorization of the Congress, which was radical Republican at the time, kept funding going for something that was called the Negro Removal Office, and it was sort of patterned on the Indian Removal Office, and it was part of the whole repatriation to Africa kind of idea, argument being made that Lincoln had a particular approach that other people did that was sort of European racialist, that blacks were not equal to, but they should be in their own element, basically. They shouldn't be here. And I can't, this was quite late in his presidency, and it just seems to me that it needs to be explained in some way, and I can't. And I'd like for you to. Another thing about, since you were just talking about Mary Todd, she had a very close relationship to an African American woman who was in the worked in the White House with her. I'm drawing a blank on her name as well, but I'm wondering whether the close relationship in a not in the typical servant-master relationship had an effect in perhaps affecting Lincoln's understanding of the differences, and so I don't know how clear that is.
It's all very clear.
Okay,
I'll do the second part first because it's easier. The seamstress that you refer to is Elizabeth Keckley, who ironically had been Jefferson Davis's wife's seamstress and then became Mary's employee and also friend. Mary was not easy to have friends. It was always better to pay friends, to be friends. And, yeah, she did do some consciousness raising. I think it was because of Lizzie Keckley that Lincoln found out that there were so-called contraband camps around his country house in Washington, the soldiers' home. He visited them. He heard them singing. He realized that there were huge throngs of people fleeing slavery without the Emancipation Proclamation being in effect. And I think, and then his wife came to him and asked him to donate money to buy them blankets and for the cold weather. So, yeah, she had some effect, I think, on Mary, certainly, and maybe through Mary Lincoln. The other issue is much more complicated, the whole issue of called colonization. There was no office of Negro removal. I think that's an exaggeration of my friend, Brother Bennett, who I've debated several times. And he uses evidence that he wants to use and omits other evidence. But let me just do colonization really quickly. Lincoln was an early believer in colonization. He was certainly a believer in white labor. He didn't early foresee a biracial society. Very few people did. He believed that it would be less threatening to racist white Southerners and racist Northerners if African Americans, or they weren't known as such then, if slaves could go to the Caribbean or Africa. where they would not be ostracized, where they would not be find their role limited, and where they would, you know, their absence would create opportunities for free labor and prosperity for white people. Sure, he believed that when he was a young man. It was actually considered a very philanthropic position at one time in the 1840s and 1830s. One of the things one of the many things Lincoln did in the period after he decided to issue the Emancipation Proclamation is keep the colonization chatter going. And he thought it was necessary to make the public believe that he wasn't liberating slaves because it was, as he put it, out of the bosom of philanthropy, that he was doing it as a military measure, as a necessity to win the war, destroying the domestic labor situation in the South and improving the military situation by allowing for the recruitment of black soldiers. He thought he would lose public opinion. He would perhaps lose Kentucky and other border states, maybe even Maryland, where Washington, D.C. was located, if it was a liberation movement for the sake of liberation only. So he kept up the chatter on colonization. Was he right to do so? No. Was he sincere about it? At that point, I actually don't think he was. I think it was a public relations ploy, and he's had to pay the price in history for flirting with the idea for as long as he did. In the end, he didn't spend much of the congressional appropriation he had to do the plan, and that's one indication, I think, that he didn't take it seriously once he realized that African Americans were fighting for their own freedom in the ranks. He realized that there would be no way to deny them citizenship and ultimately the vote.
We have just about 10 minutes left. I hope the caller will forgive me for coming in here and wanting to get us into some different areas in the time that we have remaining. Also, of course, invite other people to call as well. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Harold Holzer. He's written widely on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. He's co-authored 30 books. He's the co-chair of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. His new book is Lincoln President-Elect. It's looks at the period between Lincoln's election and inauguration. One of the things that Lincoln was doing at this time that he had to do was to select a cabinet. And Lincoln apparently said that within a day or so of the election, he had in his head and maybe actually had written down a list of people that he was considering for cabinet positions. And apparently the person who was number one on the list was Seward, whom he had defeated for the nomination, who was apparently his one and only choice for Secretary of State. There are apparently some other people on this initial list that he did actually end up with as his cabinet. But this process actually took a long time. It was into the new year before this was actually settled.
In fact, I will go a little further than that. The whole process became sort of a mess, and Seward, who was his first choice, took a while to accept, then he finally accepted, and then he withdrew because he didn't like some of the other choices. Gideon Welles, to whom Lincoln told the story initially that he had decided on his cabinet before he went to sleep on election night, liked the idea of believing that story, but Welles mounted a huge and ferocious campaign to get a job in the cabinet. He had all his friends write. He offered to go to Springfield. If he was so sure that Lincoln had decided on a place for Welles in the cabinet, then why did he mount a campaign to get a job? In fact, the governor of Massachusetts, Charles Francis Adams of Cambridge, other people from New England were all considered as New England's representative. And that famous list that my friends David Donald and Doris Goodwin have talked about, I'm a little dubious about it. My another friend, John Sellers, who is the Lincoln specialist at the Library of Congress, was good enough to say, you know, he said, "Are you going to write about that list?" And I said, "Well, yeah, everybody has, you know, writes about that list." And he said, "Well, you ought to see it. I don't think anybody's really seen it." So I looked at the, it's actually right there in the Lincoln Papers if you can find it online, and certainly in Washington. I'm not sure that list is in Lincoln's handwriting. It's not in the Lincoln Papers per se. It's in the Nicolay Papers in the back end of the Lincoln Papers. It's on a plain note card. I don't think the handwriting is Lincoln's. Now, I've had a little bit of a debate about it with my friend Dan Weinberg, who is the proprietor of the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago, and he certainly is the expert on Lincoln's handwriting. He knows more about it than anybody, including me. And he says that he thinks it might be. And, you know, if Lincoln wrote it at night, maybe he was sleepy, maybe he had his head under the covers with a flashlight or the 19th century equivalent of that. I'm not sure. I do know that it's something of a crock that it reflects his determination to appoint exactly that cabinet at that moment. It's not dated either, by the way, so I don't know when he wrote it. But he was considering Southerners. He was considering, you know, many people. And he did want Seward to be the number one. That was not so much a novelty as it was a tradition. It was a Whig tradition. When William Henry Harrison was elected president and Henry Clay had been disappointed, he had wanted to be president desperately. The first person whom Harrison called to, not called, but contacted to be Secretary of State was Henry Clay. So there was a lot of tradition in that, and Lincoln had been a Harrison supporter. I'm sure he knew the story.
One thing that I'm interested in, I hope that it doesn't seem too inconsequential, but I guess I raise the point simply because nowadays we're so critical of media for concentrating on things that maybe don't matter that much. I guess I was interested and entertained by the amount of conversation in media and otherwise that resulted from Lincoln's decision to grow his beard.
And wasn't it a clever thing for him to do? Because for 2 weeks, nobody talked about
it. Gave people something else to talk about. That's right.
It was a great conversation changer. And remember, the media was it was not just like today when you could switch off between MSNBC and Fox to get the two sides of the story. The newspapers were openly and completely partisan. Almost every city, small and medium sized, had two papers, a Democratic paper and a Republican paper. And you were sure to read nasty stories about Lincoln in the Democratic press. And in Chicago, it was the Chicago Daily Times, and pro-Lincoln stories in the Chicago Press and Tribune. So Lincoln, you know, had a nice little story to tell that wasn't about politics. It was about the little girl in Westfield, New York, who had suggested that he looked too thin to be president and without whiskers. And very interesting decision, and lots of cute stories, teasing stories. But again, even though people wrote, you know, Lincoln is putting on airs with an H in front of the airs, it sort of cooled things down for a little bit anyway.
Mm-hmm. One thing also I want to have you talk about, you know, we discussed the fact that previous historians, other historians have written about this period and have faulted Lincoln for his judgment or his lack of aggressive activity to try to keep the Union together and so forth. There was the one thing here that even Lincoln said he regretted, and that it was his decision about the way in which he entered Washington, D.C.
Yes. Boy, that is a tough one. I mean, here he is going in public in front of so many people, exposing himself to danger, and yet at the last minute he is convinced that there is a credible threat to his safety in Baltimore, the one southern city that he's going to go to en route to Washington, and he allows himself to be convinced that he needs to travel incognito at night, change his schedule, and even not wear his famous hat, top hat, and instead wear a soft hat so he doesn't look like himself.
Mm.
And he paid the price. He was lampooned mercilessly as a coward for doing that, and it took him a week to gain his traction again once he was in Washington. And I think he believed the threat. I mean, he heard it from two sources. It confirmed an earlier report in New York, and I think that the deciding moment came when he said, if there is in very brief, the plot was to attack him as he changed railroad stations to change trains. He said, well, won't the local police help you guys, meaning the five or six military men who were in his entourage? And they said, you know, we think in a pinch the police force will turn. They will turn against you. They're not loyal. I think that convinced him that he was just it was just too dangerous. On the other hand, I've never been able to understand why he let his wife and children follow the route as announced publicly, because their train was surrounded by an angry crowd, and they were yelled at, and it was must have been very unpleasant and uncomfortable. And yet Lincoln seemed totally unconcerned about their safety. Very perplexing. I chalk some of it up to exhaustion. Imagine a journey of 11 days, you know, on changing trains, endlessly going off on parades, hotels, late-night receptions, early morning breakfasts, and train travel, even in the plush accommodations he had, wasn't easy in those days. He was just probably tired.
You'd certainly have to take note of all the many threats that had been made against him starting immediately when he was elected. People actually apparently even sent him things like jars of poison preserves.
Absolutely, and drawings of himself hanging from a sour apple tree, and all of that. Someone sent him the secession ordinance from South Carolina, signed the Palmetto Boys, which is a more subtle threat than he and one. Some of them are unprintable or unreadable on the radio. We'll put a poison in your dumpling, you son of a bee, and then worse. Using phrases that I thought were invented in the 60s, the 1960s, not the 1860s. So I was pretty shocked by some of this stuff.
Yeah. And that I suppose that again goes back to...
You got me right off that topic, I see. I wasn't going to do anything.
I trust you implicitly.
Okay, good.
I know you would never do anything like that. It tries, in looking at that, maybe get you back in the frame of mind of what people thought was going to happen, what people thought that Lincoln's victory meant. And of course, that depended upon how you felt about the issue of slavery and so forth. But the atmosphere, it's probably difficult to imagine what that it would have been.
I think people on both sides knew that it was historic, just as I think they sense now that there is an historic moment. And I think that there is also a feeling now that there's going to be a very difficult, challenging transition. Both men who are running for president today have distanced themselves from the incumbent. There is a crisis in the country that is going to be a huge challenge. The difference is that both candidates to succeed President Bush are making proposals to meet the crisis, you know, sitting in on legislative sessions to legislate the crisis, but there's still going to be that interregnum. We just hope it's not a secession winter. Hope it thaws early and stays warm.
And on Lincoln's part, I suppose you really have to wonder, would there have been some point here after the election when Lincoln said to himself, and he actually did say things like this, but sort of said to himself, well, now I've gone and done it. I've actually been elected, and now I'm going to have to go and do it. And
you know what happened to him the night he was elected? He spent the night in the Springfield Telegraph office getting, you know, election returns on wire, getting slaps on the back, going to the local ice cream parlor to have ice cream and cake and confections, and having to make speeches. And it was exciting. Even won his hometown by a handful of votes, which he really wanted to do. It was a very split town. And then when he goes out in the dark of night, just as he's about to go walk home, he says, "God help me, God help me."
Do you think that he felt that there was a serious question about whether, in fact, he himself personally would survive the war or would survive his presidency?
I think he had reason to worry about whether he would make it to Washington. He was entertaining the idea of going early, and even for a minute entertained the idea of taking the oath of office in Springfield, by which time he would have the United States Army to take him to Washington. So I think he was concerned from the very beginning, but he was also very fatalistic, and he was like that to the end. If anyone wants to take my life, he believed they would, and nothing can stop them. And he allowed himself to believe that, as he put it, assassination was not in the American character, something that he that we live to regret many times over, but he really believed it at that time.
I suppose, just as a way of finishing up, I suppose that any good historian would say that the final history of anything is never really written. Mm-hmm. But with someone like Lincoln, where so much has been written, and the last few years have been a lot of new books written about Lincoln, I'm sure there'll be even more as we go into next year. Are there really things about him that we still don't know, important things that we still don't know?
I don't think that there is a revelation out there. I think that we have variations on the theme, which are important. I mean, if you can stimulate a discussion between Lerone Bennett and me, or Lerone Bennett and others, about whether Lincoln was a sincere emancipator or not, that's worth talking about, because it touches on white-black relations then, now, and in the future. If you can create an example about what a president-elect should do, it could calm crises. And, when I wrote this book, I didn't think there would be any kind of a huge crisis or nervousness or anxiety any more than there is usually between the election and the inauguration. Maybe there's something that someone can learn and glean from this that would be useful, and that's always the hope. So I think lots of twists and turns on the main story, but I would be shocked if some major event took place.
Our guest for this hour, Harold Holzer, is the co-chairman of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. He's authored or co-authored 30 books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. His most recent is Lincoln, President-Elect. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He'll be in Chicago at the end of the week, Friday evening at 6 at the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop. He'll be there to make a talk and an appearance, and that's on West Chicago Avenue in Chicago. They have a website if you'd like to find out more about the bookshop, and you certainly would be welcome to stop by and see him. And, of course, if you're interested in reading this book or Lincoln at Cooper Union or his others, you can head to the bookstore or the library and look for them. And we want to say to you, Mr. Holzer, well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
It's always great to talk to you. I appreciate it.